It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stay with us next hour when we talk with a presidential historian about the impeachment inquiry and what this means for this moment in political history. That is after 8. But first, greenhouse gas emissions from commercial flights are growing at a faster pace than scientists predicted. And a UN committee has agreed on a handful of resolutions to put up for a vote this week as the aviation industry is undergoing increased scrutiny for its impact on global warming. Are you traveling less by plane due to carbon emissions? Did you fly more in the past? Have you ever bought a carbon offset? We're at 800-642-1234. Eric Carlson is co-founder and president of the CarbonFund.org Foundation. It supports the reduction of carbon dioxide emissions through third-party renewable energy, through energy efficiency, reforestation projects around the world. Eric, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me.
So how much does air travel affect our environment?
So air travel overall makes up about 2.5%, maybe 3% of global carbon emissions. So it's not a huge number, but it is growing globally, especially as countries like China and others increase their travel exponentially over the last 20 years, and they're projected to do it even more. So it's becoming a bigger and bigger problem, and it's also a difficult one, as you can imagine, to deal with. You have large-scale problems on the ground with power plants and things like that, that if you solve part of it, you kind of solve a lot of it, or at least there's a mechanism for. So air travel, it's small, but it's growing, and it's not the easiest thing to fix.
How do U.S. flights compare to other countries? Are we a bigger source of aviation emissions? You mentioned China there.
Yes, yeah, so the U.S. and China make up, I think, about a quarter, 20 to 25% of global aviation emissions. So, you know, are we responsible for more? We certainly are. But on sort of a per mile basis, it really comes down to which airlines are doing the efficiency of their fleets, the things that they can do internally. So the U.S. and China are definitely the two biggest emitters, followed by the European Union.
When we talk about the carbon footprint, like air travel, what does that actually mean? How is that calculated?
With airlines, it's not that difficult to figure out what the carbon footprint is. We know how many miles people fly, and we know how much jet fuel they use, and we know the carbon footprint of burning jet fuel. So just as an example, if you were to fly from, say, Milwaukee to Orlando, you would be emitting round trip about 1,400 pounds or so of carbon dioxide emissions. From New York to Los Angeles would be even more. International flights are even more than that. And there's a little bit of distinction, between airlines. Some have more efficient fleets than others. Some are doing more with biofuels than others. And then long-haul flights are sort of lower on a per mile basis than short haul, just from the efficiency you gained by sitting at 30,000 feet for that much longer.
So as you partner with airlines like JetBlue, like Delta, explain for us this offset of the carbon footprint. How do these offsets work?
Mm-hmm. So the customer, they buy from sort of beginning to end, the customer buys their ticket. They calculate how far they're going, and on a per mile or the segment basis, we know how much they're responsible. And let's just say it's 1,000 pounds of carbon dioxide emissions. And through their donation to an organization like CarbonFund.org, we then use that donation and we reduce 1,000 pounds of carbon emissions somewhere else. Obviously, we can't reduce it on that particular plane, but we can plant a number of trees. We can help build a windmill in Wisconsin or in Texas. We can preserve land in Brazil, and other, and you know, and other things like that. The idea here is to, if you produce 1,000 pounds of carbon emissions, where are you going to reduce 1,000 pounds of carbon emissions so that you are at least carbon neutral and you're neutral as far as global warming and the planet is concerned?
We're talking with Eric Carlson. He's president of CarbonFund.org Foundation. You can join in on the conversation around offsets, 800-642-1234. Are you traveling less by plane due to carbon emissions? Did you used to travel more in the past? How have you cut down? Have you ever bought a carbon offset? Why did you decide to do it? Would you recommend others try it? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Eric, what is the cost here? How much does a carbon offset cost?
So for, to do, it varies, as you might expect. If you're supporting solar energy, it's going to cost more than wind energy, and preserving forestry is more. But as a general rule, if you're, let's take that Milwaukee to Orlando flight again, you're probably looking at about $5 round trip. So it's a, you know, 1 or 2% of the overall cost of the flight is all it takes to make that flight effectively carbon neutral on the planet.
And I understand these offsets are tax deductible?
If you're donating to a nonprofit, there are nonprofit and for-profit companies that that do this. But yes, to an organization like ours, they're tax deductible because you're making a donation to a nonprofit that is then providing a public good.
Well, when you buy a carbon offset, depending on where you buy it, it's not always clear where that money is going to end up. How do you know if a carbon offset program is legitimate, is doing what you are asking it to do?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, so you should be able to have some choice. And there are a number of groups out there that do this. You should be able to have some choice as to where your money goes. Is it going to support renewable energy? Is it going to support energy efficiency or forestry? You may not get to select the exact project that you want to. And then the question that you're raising is essential. It's very it's very good that, is it real and how do I know? And for that, there are a number of third-party standards developed by hundreds and hundreds of scientists, and there are protocols. So, for instance, one of the protocols is called the Verified Carbon Standard, and they have their systems where they go out and they test the if it's the wind energy, how much was created. How many credits are we going to generate out of this? Who certified this? So there are third-party auditors that get involved in it. And then how many credits are going to be available from this project? And then each credit is going to have its own serial number. So that way you know that it is real, because there's a, you have followed through from the beginning to the end of, you know, this was a project, this is how much it was supposed to reduce, this is how much it actually reduced, and these are the serial numbers that came off of it. And then you need to make sure that only that each serial number is only used once. For an organization like ours, we go through a number of audits. Of course, we have a financial audit each year, but we also have a project audit. So we know if somebody donated to, if a whole group of donors wanted to offset, say, 10,000 tons of wind energy collectively, then our auditor says, okay, show us the receipt, show us the chain that shows that you offset 10,000 tons of wind energy.
Pausing right there with Eric Carlson. He heads up CarbonFund.org Foundation. You can join in on this back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about carbon offsets and air travel. The airline industry predicts major growth over the next decades. And meanwhile, a United Nations group is closer to establishing a long-term goal for cutting greenhouse gas emissions from international aviation. There's a vote on resolutions this week. Do you think about carbon emissions when you fly? Have you changed how much you fly? Have you ever bought a carbon offset? Why did you decide to do that? And what would you tell others? Join in 800-642-1234. Eric Carlson is president of the CarbonFund.org Foundation, and he stays with us. Let's go to Mark, who is joining us from Menominee. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Say, my question would be, say for like a family of four, like, is there a number that you would have for like what their carbon footprint would be? And if you would, like, how many trees would I have to plant to offset that?
Mark, thanks for the call. What is the multiplier effect here, Eric?
Sure. So the average American is responsible for about 50,000 pounds of carbon emissions each year. So a family of four would be about 200,000 pounds. And that, using, again, our rough numbers, somebody would offset that for maybe $1,000 a year, so about $80 a month. How many trees? Trees aren't a great example because you plant seedlings and then you have to wait for them to grow. It would certainly be a couple hundred trees, but it would have just sort of a long growth period. There are other ways to do it by, say, preserving existing land, keeping existing trees from getting cut down as well.
Yeah, so if trees aren't really a great path here, what is a really great place that you're seeing putting these carbon offsets? What is working well?
Well, first of all, I do think planting trees are essential. It's just a little bit, just a longer growth period. But to answer your question, really, as long as you're reducing emissions, you should select the projects that you personally like. So some people really like wind energy. That's a great way, and it's very easy to calculate. It's very easy to wrap your head around. Energy efficiency is another one. We see truck stops across the country going electric so that truck drivers aren't idling their trucks all night. That's a great and measurable way to do so. And then preserving land. And our organization, for instance, we're preserving 750,000 acres, which is roughly the size of Rhode Island, in the Brazilian rainforest, and we're keeping those trees that were slated to be cut down from being cut down. So it's not planting, it's preserving. But those are a few of the ways you can do it.
So you can do things that are harming the environment, like taking that long-haul flight, and you're then trying to cancel out the harm somewhere else. But is that really how we can combat climate change in the end? Is it that simple?
Well, it's not that simple, but, you know, the idea here is that we're all responsible for carbon emissions. When you eat food, when you go to grandma's house for Thanksgiving, you're responsible for some level of pollution. And we can either not go to grandma's house for Thanksgiving or we can offset that somewhere. Of course, we can also, you know, buy lower on the food chain. We can travel a lot less. So there are things you can do internally. We say reduce what you can, and then you can offset the rest, offset what you can't. And between that, as long as you're getting your overall emissions to neutral, you are being neutral to the planet. In essence, the planet only cares about the net amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. So you can have a pretty first world life if you continue to make changes internally and you make the necessary offsets externally while you're doing so.
Talking with Eric Carlson, he heads up the CarbonFund.org Foundation. We're looking at carbon offsets with your questions and your stories as well at 800-642-1234. Eric, what are the airlines doing here in order to reduce emissions and fuel consumption? Are you seeing the legacy airlines make changes?
So they are making changes, some slower than others. One of the synergies that they have is that their biggest expense is fuel. It's higher than their labor costs. So they certainly have a financial incentive to reduce that thing that is also polluting the environment, burning jet fuel. But you see airlines switching to more efficient engines that have come out in the last decade or so. You see those winglets on planes. You see a lot of things happening around the edges, I would say, in the 5, 10, 12% reduction range. I assume that they're getting better with their flight patterns and things like that. But they're a good example that will be an industry that where it will be hard to get to zero emissions. It will be, which is why we need the ground-based emissions to maybe do more of the heavy lifting in terms of reducing emissions. That's where, you know, renewable energy plants and things like that come in.
Well, let's go to Mary Kay now in Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hello. I'd like to talk about energy efficiency. I live in an apartment complex. The lights are on 24 hours a day. It can be 50 degrees outside and people have their air conditioners on. None of the appliances are energy efficient. There's no dishwasher. So a lot of this contributes to pollution, too. We need to become more energy efficient, use a lot less.
So Mary Kay is saying this is not, you know, this extends well beyond air travel here, Eric.
She's exactly right. Now, ironically, living in an apartment where any heat that is lost, it goes to the left, right, and above you, is a pretty efficient way of living versus, say, being in a 2,500 square foot home. But she is right. If there are lights on all the time, if there are old appliances, that's a huge waste. And sometimes, you know, if your utilities are included in your rent, you may not have an incentive to do anything about it. And that's something that should be addressed as well.
Well, we saw over the weekend a UN aviation agency voted to decide on a long-term greenhouse gas emissions goal by 2022. What are you watching for there out of the UN?
Yeah, we're really glad that that's happening. I believe it's 191 countries coming together with their aviation plan. Aviation is perfect for the UN because we're talking about something that crosses international boundaries. It's good to see them all getting together and coming up with a solution that's going to affect U.S. airlines, European airlines, but also developing country airlines also. The exact numbers, I think, will fluctuate over the next, you know, 4 or 5 years, and I'm sure it won't be a perfect process, but it's really important to have everybody at the table. And I will tell you, the airlines have been active. The ones that we work with, JetBlue, Alaska Airlines, they've been actively involved in this. They do see their role in this and want to be productive in terms of solving it. That's what we've seen from our examples.
Are you concerned about these studies coming out saying that air travel is growing a lot and we're going to have to do a lot more of carbon offset here if we want to keep up with what's going on in air travel?
Yeah, what we see is, you know, carbon offsetting is an essential part of getting your carbon emissions to zero today, while you're also making the changes that will hopefully reduce your overall carbon footprint and thus reduce the need for offsets in the future. So what we'd like to see, and we're seeing, again, each airline is taking their own path, is the emissions are coming down slowly. Biofuels are just really being experimented with now, but that could be a big part of the solution going forward. And then, but that offset allows you to get to zero carbon emissions today, and you can reduce your impact on the, just with regard to climate change, you can reduce that effectively to zero today, but the airlines need to then fill in the back of that with the technological solutions.
Well, as we wrap up here, besides a carbon offset, what is the workaround here to try to reduce your carbon emissions?
So, you know, like I said, our motto is reduce what you can, offset what you can't. And I think there are a lot of things that that beyond air travel, people can certainly travel less. But, you know, within your home, you have two main main emission sources. One is your electricity and the other is whatever you use to heat. With electricity, there are a lot of, you know, 100% renewable options. And in fact, Wisconsin is a real leader in the development of wind energy in the country. So that's something that people can do today to get themselves to mostly carbon neutral. Electric cars are coming down in price and they're gaining in efficiency. But, you know, your big three that you can really address are your home, your car, and your air travel. And there are solutions for each of those.
Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Eric Carlson is co-founder of the CarbonFund.org Foundation. Coming up, we have a line to Attorney General Josh Call. Stay with us. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kahn. Thanks for being here. You have a line to Attorney General Josh Call. We're doing a roundup of issues circulating in the state Justice Department, starting with conflicts over legal settlements and Wisconsin not being part of that tentative multi-state settlement agreement with the maker of OxyContin. What questions do you have for the Attorney General? How do you think Wisconsin should handle legal settlements involving state government? Should the Attorney General be required to receive the legislature's approval? How do you think the money from legal settlements should be spent? We're at 800-642-1234. Attorney General Josh Call, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
You and Republican leaders in the legislature have really been battling over these legal settlements involving the state. Republicans want the authority to review authorized settlements before you act on behalf of the state. So what are your concerns with the process at this point?
Well, this is an unfortunate situation, Kate. This is a product of the extraordinary session where the Republicans in the legislature raced back into session following the 2018 elections to undermine my authority and also to undermine Governor Evers' authority. One of the things they did is that they changed the way that settlements have worked in Wisconsin for a very long time. Now, instead of resolving cases the way that they have been resolved for a long time, certain cases need to get approval from either a legislative committee or a legislative intervener, or somebody who gets into a case before they can be resolved. Unfortunately, the legislature didn't create a process for how that was supposed to work. So for months, my office has been attempting to work with the legislature to create a process that's going to be workable and that can allow us to continue working to get the best possible settlements for Wisconsinites.
You asked Republicans to sign these non-disclosure agreements before they could review potential settlements. Why do you think those non-disclosure agreements are necessary?
So what we have asked the legislature to do is, if we are providing information that's confidential in nature, we have tried to create a way for them to keep that information confidential. And there's all sorts of information in a legal case that might be confidential. For example, our legal strategy is something that we don't want to disclose to the other side in the case, and so we need to keep confidential. There are also sometimes confidential documents or information you learn in the course of a case. And then sometimes settlement offers themselves are confidential. So we've been trying to create a process that will allow for confidentiality to be maintained. We have suggested confidentiality agreements. The Democrats on the Joint Finance Committee have said they'll just vote for the settlements that our office thinks are in the best interest of the state. But the Republicans on the committee have rejected both of those options. They've come back with proposals, but both of the proposals they've offered are ones that the Legislative Reference Bureau has said won't, in fact, protect confidentiality. So we continue to try to work with them, but so far the Republicans on the Joint Finance Committee haven't found a solution that they're willing to accept that will help us clean up this mess that they made in the extraordinary session.
Is this slowing down the process as you work through settlements? What's at stake here?
It is slowing down the process. it impacts cases in a lot of ways. I mean, certainly it makes getting settlements in these cases so far impossible. But, you know, as you litigate a case, it's also helpful to know how you're likely to potentially, so you have that idea as you're moving forward with the case. This process has made that much more difficult. So the outcome is that if we don't ultimately reach an agreement here, there are going to be some cases that go to trial that could have been resolved. But also, the state is involved in regularly in multi-state cases. We're one of many states that are involved. And those are valuable for the state because we can leverage the resources, not just of our own office at the Department of Justice, but of AG's offices around the country to work to get good resolutions. And if we can't figure out a way to enter into settlement agreements, we're potentially going to miss out on those settlements. And that's going to be harmful to Wisconsinites. And it's going to mean that we're not recovering as much money for things like consumer protection violations or other violations of the law as we could be.
Talking with Attorney General of Wisconsin Josh Call on the line, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for the Attorney General? How do you think Wisconsin should be handling legal settlements involving state government? Should the Attorney General be required to receive the legislature's approval? Sign off. Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Attorney General, let's look at one of these cases, Purdue Pharma, that has been in the headlines, reportedly worth $12 billion. What are you seeking from Purdue Pharma over its role in the opioid crisis? Because Wisconsin is not part of the tentative settlement.
Yeah, earlier this year, we filed suit against two Purdue Pharma entities and also Richard Sackler, who's a former president and co-chair of the board of Purdue Pharma, and we've alleged that they engaged in false and deceptive marketing practices by downplaying the risks of opioids and overstating the benefits of opioids, and that those actions contributed to the opioid epidemic. There was a settlement that has become public that was proposed by Purdue Pharma and members of the Sackler family. Approximately half of the state's agreed to that resolution, but approximately half of us don't think it goes far enough. I don't think it guarantees enough in payments from members of the Sackler family, the family that owns Purdue Pharma. Purdue has declared bankruptcy, and there will be bankruptcy proceedings, but the members of the Sackler family made billions and billions of dollars as a result of Purdue's efforts, and I think they need to provide more to the settlement than they have. I should also note that my view and the view I know of a number of other AGs is that the value of the settlement that's been reported overstates what the value of that settlement is. So we're going to continue seeking to pursue justice in this case.
It sounds like Wisconsin is holding out here.
Well, what's going to happen next because of this bankruptcy is there's going to be a process where we see if the bankruptcy court essentially accepts the settlement and requires all of the states to enter into it, or it rejects the settlement, and in which case there would be proceedings in the bankruptcy, and we'll see whether the members of the Sackler family become part of those proceedings as well or not. But, our hope is to continue, first of all, seeking recovery from Purdue through the bankruptcy process or otherwise, but also to continue seeking recovery from Richard Sackler.
During your campaign for Attorney General last year, you pledged to hold Big Pharma accountable. You also talked about the importance of expanding addiction treatment services. Have you seen Wisconsin taking steps to improve treatment?
We have made some progress on that front. The new budget contains an additional $1 million to support treatment and diversion programs. Those are programs that are available for people who end up in the criminal justice system and have an addiction. They help not focus on incarcerating people who have an addiction, but rather in helping those folks get treatment so that they can get back on their feet and hopefully not continue to end up in the criminal justice system. I think we need to continue expanding that program, but it's good to see that there's been an expansion. But part of expanding treatment is going to be based on holding pharmaceutical companies accountable for their role in this epidemic, because when we recover funds, as I was mentioning before, from whether it's Purdue Pharma or Richard Sackler or anyone else whose false and deceptive conduct contributed to the epidemic, those are funds that we can put towards treatment and prevention and enforcement efforts in communities around Wisconsin.
Over the summer, the state approved hiring the equivalent of 65 county prosecutors to help with the increasing caseloads. Where do you see the most need for these additional prosecutors, additional resources? Are you still there, Attorney General? I think we've... are you still there, Attorney General?
I am. I apologize. I was saying I'm glad to see that these funds are in place because our criminal justice system has been underfunded for a long time in Wisconsin. There are shortages at DA's offices around the state, and this is going to help us work to address those shortages, which means that there will be less of a delay in getting justice for victims of crime and that defendants get their day in court sooner. It also means that we have more prosecutors who can help with diversion and other alternatives to incarceration programs.
Let's bring in Ann now from Campbell Sport. Hi, Ann.
Hi. My question is, what did the legislators, the Republicans, hope to accomplish by passing this lame duck decision? What would the benefit be to citizens to have them involved in these court cases? And also, do these legislators have a law degree? Are they qualified to get involved in this sort of thing? Because I would think this is the Attorney General's job. That's why we elected him.
Anne, thanks for the call, Attorney General.
Well, I think Anne is exactly right in the points that she's getting at. For a long time, this is authority that the Attorney General has exercised, and voters of Wisconsin made a decision in November of 2018, and the legislature essentially attempted to undermine the effects of that decision with these extraordinary session laws. And now we are, this not only undermines the results of the election, but now we're stuck with this process that so far has not worked. And it's harming Wisconsinites because, cases that the Department of Justice pursues can involve environmental enforcement. They can involve enforcing consumer protection laws against people who've, committed consumer fraud, for example. We should be able to get justice in those cases. And if we can't settle them, that means more cases are going to trial, more resources will be used on individual cases, and there will be fewer cases in which we can get justice for Wisconsinites. So, they are bad laws. I certainly hope that they will be repealed at some point or struck down. But in the meantime, we're going to continue to do our best to work within the constraints that we have to try to reach an agreement with the legislature so we can move forward with cases.
We have Attorney General Josh Call on the cell phone as we work through issues at the Justice Department. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we have Attorney General Josh Call on the line here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Working through a number of issues, including now the fact that Governor Tony Evers wants new gun laws, and we've seen the Attorney General standing next to the governor at those press conferences urging lawmakers to come to the table on gun safety legislation. So what questions do you have for the Attorney General? How do you want lawmakers to address gun violence? Join in at 800-642-1234 as Attorney General Josh Call stays with us for the next 10 minutes. Let's go back to the phones now. Jerry joining us from Amory. Jerry, hi.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
I'm interested in what happened with the money that came from the tobacco settlement. I think when Governor Thompson was in charge of things, Mr. Call would have some information about that.
Jerry, thanks for the call. And Attorney General, what about the tobacco settlement?
The state of Wisconsin actually continues to receive money from the tobacco settlement. And those funds have been spent for a number of different uses in Wisconsin. One of the things that is different about these opioid litigations that are going on right now is we've seen in Wisconsin, I think it's 71 out of 72 counties file suit, and around the country, some cities have filed suit as well. And I know that the concern that a lot of jurisdictions have is that what happens with the recovery from opioid cases not be similar to what happened with tobacco. I think a lot of people were frustrated that settlement funds from the tobacco cases didn't go just to public health and to remediating the effects of tobacco use, but instead went to all sorts of different purposes. What I would like to see with the recovery of any funds from the opioid cases is that those funds go to our communities to work to address the opioid epidemic. It's ongoing. It is. It has been devastating for communities around the state, and we need resources to address it.
Let's bring in Patrick now from Richland County. Patrick, hi.
Hey, good morning. Great program. And, you know, to a lot of us out here, is it possible, it kind of looks like, but is this possible that the reason the Republicans kind of wanted in on this would be to make sure that the Attorney General doesn't get too hard on the moneyed man on these settlements, and then, you know, they can kind of protect, well, their interest.
Patrick, thanks for the call. And Patrick is concerned about, you know, those backroom deals, apparently, and who does what.
Yeah, you know, these are settlements, as I mentioned before, that have been handled a particular way for a long time. And, you know, voters made their decision in November of 2018. And, you know, Republicans in the legislature decided that they think that they should have a say in how these cases are resolved. And the effect has been, as I mentioned before, that it's not been workable. And so it has interfered with our resolving these cases. And, you know, that means that resources are going to trying to work out an agreement here, potentially to continuing to litigate cases that could be handled differently. I would rather see those resources be used where they're supposed to be, which is holding polluters accountable, holding accountable those who violate our consumer protection laws. That's what we should be doing with our AG's office, not figuring out how to make this extremely difficult process workable with the Joint Finance Committee.
You and Governor Evers want the legislature to pass a red flag law so people can petition the courts to take guns over safety concerns. Republicans are saying that you really want to take away people's lawfully owned firearms. What is your response?
We have all seen the effects of these acts of mass shootings around the country. There have been devastating consequences, obviously, in the cities where they have taken place. But we now also have had millions of kids go through lockdowns in schools in the U.S. Far more have gone through lockdown drills at our schools. You know, there is a far too high rate of suicide and gun violence generally. And what I would like to see are some common sense steps that can help us address those problems. There are two measures that I support, that Governor Evers supports, that I think can make a difference and help save lives while completely respecting Second Amendment rights. That would be expanding background checks and a red flag law. Right now, the vast majority of firearm sales go through background checks, but there's essentially a loophole that allows private sales to be conducted without a background check. And what that means is that the person who's selling the firearm doesn't know whether the person who's buying it is prohibited from possessing one. So somebody who is prohibited because, say, they've committed a felony can evade a background check. I think we should be closing that loophole. What a red flag law would do is allow a family member or a household member or a law enforcement officer who sees warning signs that somebody is suicidal or potentially is going to commit an act of gun violence, and allow them to go to a judge to seek an order that would require that person temporarily to surrender their firearms. So these are laws that are focused on limiting access to firearms for people who are a danger to themselves or others, and hopefully can help save lives.
The governor has said he's open to a mandatory gun buyback program to reduce the number of firearms in the state. Would you support that kind of buyback program?
Well, I think the governor has made clear that he doesn't expect that any sort of proposal along those lines will be introduced. And I don't think a proposal along those lines should be introduced in this legislative session. I think our focus should be on the two measures I talked about, universal background checks and a red flag law. Those are proposals that about 4 out of 5 Wisconsinites support. And this is an area where we have seen inaction for far too long. I think we can make progress if we continue to focus on these two areas. So far, the Republicans in the legislature have been unwilling even to hold a hearing discussing these measures. But we're going to continue advocating for them and hopefully make some progress.
This summer, to address growing caseloads in the crime labs here in the state approved adding the equivalent of 7 crime lab positions. Have those positions been filled?
So we've been working to comprehensively address shortages of resources at the crime labs. We've got really talented staff at our crime labs who are doing cutting-edge scientific work, but we need to make sure that they have the resources that they need so that when evidence is submitted, it gets turned around in a timely fashion. So like I said, we've been working to address that issue comprehensively. One way we did that is by requesting additional resources for the crime lab and the budget. We got some resources, but not as much as we requested. And so right now we are in the process, near the end of the process, of evaluating how to use those resources most effectively. And I expect that we will begin putting out requests to fill those positions soon.
Are you seeing an impact yet on the crime lab's responsiveness to requests for evidence tests?
Well, some of the changes that have been implemented, some were implemented before I came into office, and we continue to work to change the way that the crime labs are working. For example, we made the crime labs their own division within the Department of Justice. The crime lab director now reports directly to our deputy attorney general. And I think the crime lab has shown some improvement. We want to see improvement over a long term when it comes to turnaround times. And I expect that we're going to continue to see improvement. Like I said, we've got a really talented staff there, and they're working hard to make sure that when evidence gets submitted, it's tested in a timely and objective and accurate fashion.
Very quickly, we only have seconds left, but we've talked about settlements. We've talked about, gun laws on the table. We've looked at, the crime lab. What is your top priority as AG right now? Where do you put your focus?
Public safety is my top priority, and there are some critical issues. One is addressing our opioid epidemic and our growing meth problem through some of the measures we talked about, treatment, enforcement against people who are illegally selling drugs, but also companies that violate our consumer protection laws. And also we need to make sure we're educating people. I've also been advocating for legislation that's designed to prevent Wisconsin from having another backlog of untested sexual assault kits.
And we're going to have to pause. We're going to have to pause right there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Call is the Attorney General of Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.